I'm pretty excited to tell you about who we've got on today's show.
Who are we talking with today?
Today's episode features Vidyamala Birch. Vidyamala has been teaching meditation for over 25 years. Two particularly interesting things that we got to talk about were that she runs a very large teacher training program. And so we got to talk about the nature of teacher training programs. And the thing I was most interested in is, how do you run a large Dharma organization and keep it warm and fuzzy rather than, you know, so often these things become corporate or there's scandals. And interestingly, the coolest trivia fact that I had heard about Vidyamala is she was named one of the 100 most influential disabled people in the entire United Kingdom.
Wow, sounds like a fascinating interview. And I also love to hear about the warm and fuzzy and community side of this.
All right. Well, they want to hear it. We want to hear it. You can take it if you want, man. Go ahead.
All right, I'll take it. Hit it, John.
Vidyamala, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show this week.
It's really great to be here, and thanks so much for inviting me.
I have so many questions for you. You know, of course, I've read your bio online. I saw that you were twice ranked as one of the most influential disabled people in the entire United Kingdom. And I'm so interested to hear how you got there. Let me just ask if I could have you start out with your story. How did you get into Dharma? And more importantly, what was the path to becoming a teacher like for you?
Okay, so it's probably a little bit of an unusual story. I'll try and keep it brief. But I injured my spine when I was 16, so, you know, a really long time ago. And I had two major surgeries when I was 17, which left me with pain. And then I was in a car crash when I was 23 and fractured another part of my spine. So by the time I was 23, I had, you know, really quite significant pain in my back and impairment. And then when I was 25, I was hospitalized after a treatment went wrong. I had some injections in my spine that led to my bladder being paralyzed. So I was in hospital having a total crisis on all sorts of levels. And I had an experience one night. I was in an intensive care ward and I was really kind of agonizing about my situation and how on earth was I going to get through till the morning. You know, really kind of tortured, I would say. And then I had I suppose it was a kind of insight. It was like a voice came to me that said, you don't have to get through till the morning. You just have to live this moment and this one and this one and this one. And my experience completely changed. So it was like something rose up out of hell in a way, with a profoundly different perspective on my experience on time and space and so on. So I did get through till the morning, obviously, but I felt it was very interesting. I felt my way of understanding things had kind of collapsed into a new paradigm, the paradigm of presence, the paradigm of being present. And I often say that, you know, that night was the axis that my life has turned on. And here I am, you know, many, many years later, decades later, still making sense of that experience. You know, what does it mean to be fully present? So that was a kind of just an arrival from somewhere, some other dimension, perhaps, that was surprising. And then a few days later, the hospital chaplain came to see me. They didn't really know what to do with me medically because, you know, I had very significant problems and there wasn't a medical solution. So they sent the chaplain, and I wasn't at all religious. In fact, I was rather cynical. And this man came to see me and he was so kind. Oh, he was such a lovely person. And he held my hand and he got me to remember a time and a place when I'd been happy. So I took my mind back to the Southern Alps of New Zealand, where I'd roamed around before my accidents. I'd been super fit, really absolutely adored the mountains and the wilderness. So I took my mind back there. And then, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes, something like that passed. He brought me back and my subjective experience changed. So I felt different depending on what I'd done with my awareness, what I'd done with my mind. And that blew my mind. That also had a huge effect on me. Because prior to that, I hadn't really ever considered that I had a mind. You know, I was just alive. I'd never thought that, oh, I have this capacity for awareness. I have a mind and I can change how I feel subjectively in the moment by what I do with my mind. So when I left hospital after a few weeks, you know, I was just a very different girl. I'd had these experiences that were literally life-changing. I never tried to go back to my job. I'd worked in film, very, very long hours, terribly bad for me. I had a wonderful social worker. So I said to her, I really want to learn to meditate. So this was, you know, pre-digital times. It was in the 70s, in the 80s. So she got me cassette tapes from the library. She got me books. And I often say to people that my, you know, this very, very difficult situation I was in, it gave me the gift of time because I had months just lying on my bed, flat on my back, looking at the ceiling, investigating my mind. You know, I would never have had that opportunity if I'd been on the career treadmill and so on. So I just really examined awareness, examined my mind. Then I started doing some yoga after a year or so to try and help me recover a bit, get some strength, did some Hindu meditation. And then I went on a Buddhist weekend retreat with what was then called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order and is now called the Triratna Buddhist Order. This was in Auckland in New Zealand. And it's interesting, you know, it wasn't really the teachings that affected me initially, it was the people. I met these people who were so warm and so kind and so authentic. I think that was the thing I was most struck by, is that I suppose it was the first time I feel I'd met people who were comfortable in their own skin. Oh. And the phrase I often use is they were extraordinarily ordinary. You know, they weren't trying to be anything or be anyone. They were just kind, aware, sort of wise people. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I really want to be like that when I grow up. So I decided to commit myself to that tradition and moved to the UK in 1990 when I was 30. And I lived in a retreat center for 5 years. It's a place called Taraloka Buddhist Retreat Center for Women. A community of about 13 of us, set loads of retreats.
If it's okay, can I just ask about that? I think for a lot of people listening, going to live in a retreat center for 5 years seems like a pipe dream. Not a thing they might actually follow through on. What was the process there by which you decided you were actually so committed you're going to live in a retreat center?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I suppose all I can say is I often get these very strong intuitions and I know I have to follow them. And you've got to remember my life was still relatively in crisis. You know, I couldn't really hold down a normal job because of my disability. I guess I knew intuitively that I needed very strong medicine. That was my sense, that I needed to immerse myself in this mind training, in this awareness training. And I think I also intuited that I needed strong medicine in terms of community, because I was living, you know, out in the country with these other women who were very kind. I didn't necessarily get on with them, you know, the usual thing in community where you rub up against each other. But I often say in retrospect that that was where I learned to love and to be loved in this life. Yeah. So it was just an intuition. I thought I need this. And, you know, looking back, it is pretty remarkable. I even think that myself. It's like, wow, I went to the other side of the world. I had a really bad back. I didn't know these people, but I just knew that's what I had to do.
Did you have parents or a partner or somebody who said, this is crazy, you cannot do this?
Not really. No, that's, I mean, lucky. Yeah, exactly. I had a boyfriend in New Zealand, so I had to leave him. That was very hard. My parents, I think they didn't really understand what I was doing, but, you know, they didn't stand in my way. And I had, with my disability and stuff, the way I dealt with it in my 20s was by being fiercely independent and not really letting my family into my heart. in a certain kind of way. I regret that, really. So they wouldn't have stopped me anyway. It was more like, I just have to do this. And I asked myself two things. I did have conflict. No, do I really want to do this or should I do this? And I had two questions I asked myself when I was in New Zealand. It was, how will I feel on the day that the aeroplane leaves that I would have been on if I was going to England and if I hadn't got on it? Yeah, so the plane takes off. I'm not on it. Would I feel relief or would I feel regret? And I thought, oh, I definitely feel regret. And then the other one was, when I'm an old lady looking back on my life, would I feel relief or regret by not sort of taking this step? And I thought, oh, I definitely feel regret.
Okay. So your path starts in the hospital and leads you in not that long of a time to 5 years living in a Buddhist community.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then just after the end of that time, I got ordained into the Triratna Buddhist Order, which is when I got my name, Vidyamala. And I left the retreat center. I think with these things, there's often, they're kind of time limited. You know, you do them for a period of time. And then, you know, I just felt I needed to get back out into the world again more. And I needed to move on to a different context. So I moved to Manchester, eventually here in the UK.
And when you say ordained, do you mean that you became a nun at that point?
Well, a Triratna Buddhist Order is interesting. It's a modern Buddhist order. It was only founded in the late 60s. And the founder was a guy called Sangharakshita. He's died now. And he always says that our order is neither monastic nor lay. So it's a kind of, like, I'm not a nun in the traditional sense, but neither am I completely a lay person in the traditional sense. And the commitment is based on going for refuge to the three jewels. So that's what's important, that what's at the heart, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then in our order, we have loads of different lifestyles. You know, some people are married, some people got kids, some people live in retreat centers, some people are celibate. So we embrace lots of different lifestyles.
Yeah, my order was similar, that a lot of people ordained under the term upasaka, so that you're not celibate. You can have a job and have a family, but you're putting your commitment to the Dharma foremost in your life, so you're not entirely a lay person.
Okay, that's quite similar. Yes. Yeah, I like it. Do you like it?
Yes, I do, quite a lot. The ordination ceremony felt important in a way that feels hard to explain. Sort of like, you know, a marriage. You take two people who've been living together and sharing everything for 5 years, and they stand up and commit that they're going to keep doing this. and somehow it's significant, you know, making that commitment in front of your friends and family and clergy changes your life, I think.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely got a kind of mythic, non-conceptual, mysterious dimension, which I also really like.
Yeah. Okay, so you get to Manchester, and are you teaching at this point yet?
So in our tradition, when you're ordained, often you do start teaching like beginner's classes, you know, based on your own practice. So I did some of that. It was difficult because of my disability, but yeah, I was doing some teaching at the Manchester Buddhist Center, which I really loved. But what I was drawn to was wanting to really offer something to other people who've got bodies that are painful, because a lot of the meditation teaching that I'd had in my early days, you know, most people were young and fit in those days. Of course, yeah. It's changed now. We're an aging sangha. And so I felt I had to figure out a lot of it for myself. You know, how do you meditate in a painful body? It's a hard thing. So I started to want to develop a program that would be particularly aimed at people who are living with painful bodies for one reason or another. And in about 2000, I got a small grant from the UK government that was aimed at disabled people that wanted to contribute to the community. And I thought, well, that's me. I really would love to find a way to offer meditation awareness practices to other disabled people. And I started trying some courses in 2001. I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know if I had anything useful to say. I didn't know if anyone would come. And it was interesting because courses were free then. And I put an ad in the local paper and I was inundated with inquiries. Uh-huh. which of course was great from a certain point of view, and also made me really sad. I thought, God, there's all these people out there who have got, you know, illnesses and disabilities that, you know, they don't really know how to manage, and they're not getting help to manage those. I think Western medicine is very good at acute conditions, but chronic ongoing health conditions, it's helpful, of course. I believe in Western medicine, but the sort of management side of it can be a bit lacking sometimes. So there were all these people who were struggling. They heard about a course and they thought, oh God, I'll give that a go. So I did that in 2001. And then 2002, I had more major surgery. So I had a year off. 2003 came back. Yeah, there was definitely a sense that I had something to offer. I was refining the program, drawing on the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, and then adapting it based on my own training. In my own training, I'd always been taught to alternate mindfulness and metta bhavana. So awareness practices and kindness practices, one each day. And I found that really helpful. So it's a bit like, you know, training in presence and training in kindness as these twins. So I based my program on that. So our 8-week program is about 50% awareness and 50% compassion practices. So things were starting to really build in 2003. I was joined by two other senior members of our order, Sona Fricker and Rat Naguna, or he used his civil name, Gary Hennessy. And they were much more experienced meditators than me. They'd been at it for decades. So the three of us could really do something with this program. And after about a year, you know, I was getting much more familiar with the stats around chronic health conditions. And it's about 1 in 3 people live with a long-term health condition. 1 in 5 in developed countries live with chronic pain. And I thought, wow, there's three of us working in Manchester, running maybe 5 courses a year. We are barely scratching the surface. So that's when we very intentionally pivoted to teacher training using the cascade model. So if we trained other people to deliver our program, then way more people would be met, given the skills to help them with their suffering.
Okay, so you're thinking of teacher training as essentially a way to increase the positive impact you're seeing in your home sangha there.
Not my home sangha. I've always had quite a big vision. It's global. You know, is to increase the positive benefit around the world for all these millions of people who are struggling with health conditions. You know, you got your health condition, which is bad enough, and then you got your mind reacting to your health condition, which just makes it a whole lot worse, you know.
Tell me about how you get a teacher training program off the ground.
Okay, that's a really great question. I wouldn't necessarily recommend the path that we followed, but it's kind of, it was an organic path, and actually it's been very successful. So maybe it is a good way to go about it. And the way we went about it is Sona Rat Naguna and I, we just put on a retreat 2004. We just thought, let's put on a retreat, see if anyone comes, and kind of make it up as we go along. That's why I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But we had a lot of heart, you know, so much heart and vision and passion. And so that was our first attempt. And we learned a lot of things from that. You know, it was actually quite successful. But we realized that it would be good to be a bit more systematic, maybe, a bit more strategic, maybe. But that was the beginning, and it was very positive seeds. And I think what we got from that is, oh yeah, this is a really good thing to do. You know, that this our motivation was so pure about just wanting to give people awareness and kindness skills who are living with health conditions. So that was 2004. And then gradually over the years, we got people on the team who were experienced teachers with adult learning skills, these kind of things, school teachers, knew about education. So we didn't know that much about education as a kind of modality. We knew a lot about meditation. We knew how to teach meditation. We knew how to teach the Dharma. But teaching others to teach, well, that's a slightly different thing.
Yeah.
So you know, it's been really great to pull people onto the team, or, you know, invite people onto the team over the years who have been able to really help us develop the teacher training dimension of that.
This is really interesting because I've been, you know, talking to Dharma teachers about Dharma teaching as sort of my thing here. And this is the first time I've heard somebody talk about bringing in just teachers. So you're bringing in people with expertise in education who may actually not know anything about meditation.
No. So the people, just to clarify that, the people we drew upon or we invited in, they were also very experienced meditators. So it was people who knew about what we were doing from the inside, which I think is essential. Well, maybe it's not essential. I don't know. We could have just got some education expertise, but it was even more helpful having people that knew about meditation on the inside and then also knew about adult learning and teacher training.
And so you're talking here about going from training teachers to training trainers, right?
Yes, that's right. So initially, the language we used is a trainer is somebody who trains teachers, and a teacher is somebody who delivers the program. So we've had to even work out all the language over the years. So we've now got, I'm the founder, we've got the co-founders, and then we've got associates who run our teacher training retreats, and then they train the teachers to go out into the world and deliver the programs. So, you know, got these sort of levels of expertise that are bedded into our organization now. And, you know, it is, as I said, it's very successful. It seemed to be a really good teacher training program. I feel really proud of it. And I think one of the things I love about it is it's maintained its heart. Early on, people used to often say that they came to Breathworks for the heart. And that could easily have got squeezed out as we expanded, because that's always the risk, isn't it? Yeah. You get more successful and you lose that kind of heart essence. And I really don't think that we have. I think that's still there. And we've got a very strong emphasis on community. So once you become a Breathworks teacher, you join our community of teachers. And we've got an online community that's very alive and very engaged and so on.
Do you know about how many people have been through the teacher program?
So I can't give you the exact figures, but I think we've got about 600 teachers now in something like 35 countries.
How does one maintain a heart-centered organization of 600 people all over the world? I agree with what you say, that in a lot of cases, things start getting bureaucratic and corporate and lose the heart when it gets that big.
That is a really good question. And I find it a little bit hard to answer. It's almost like a little bit of magic or something. I think probably I have... I have an influence from that point of view, and that I'm still very passionate about what I do. And whenever anyone says to me, you know, why do you work so hard and why are you still doing it after 20 years? I always just answer the same way. And it's very simple. It's that I want to help people. Very, very simple. You know, that's why I started, because I want to help people. And that's why I'm still doing it, because I want to help people. Because my journey was, you know, it's been very rich, but it was quite hard. And quite bleak at times, just figuring out for myself, how do I train my mind and train my heart in a body that is hurting all the time and hasn't been my friend? You know, how do I befriend this body? And I thought, wow, it'd be really great if other people didn't have to go through quite such a long and lonely journey that I had to go through. And I still feel really passionate about that.
Yeah, I can hear that in your voice, how much that mission comes through when you talk. I could see how with you as one of the people at the helm, even as it grew, that passion could be infectious.
I think so. And I think now that we've got this online community, which we've only had for a year or so, it's an off-the-shelf community app, which we've been able to, you know, adapt for our use. You know, I always felt we needed to have an app, but of course, apps are very, very expensive to develop on the whole. But this one's really fantastic. And so I'm able to have my voice in there all the time as well. And we've got an amazing team. We've got something like 17 people just running Breathworks now as an organization, 55 associates. And all those people, I would say every single one of those people has caught the heart essence of what we're doing. They love working at Breathworks. And one of this is interesting. One of the things which I really love that has surprised me about long-term Dharma practice. You know, if I 30 years ago, 35 years ago, when I started to meditate, if someone had said to me, well, what will be the fruits, do you think, you know, in 35 years of practice? I think I probably would have thought, well, I'll be very calm, be very serious.
Oh, I would love that.
You know, like a nun, traditional nun. But what I've discovered, and I just adore this, is I've become much more lighthearted. So, you know, I laugh more, I have more fun, life has got more vibrant. And I think that lightheartedness is quite a feature of breathworks, which is interesting because it's a very heavy topic. You know, mindfulness of pain and illness is not a light topic, but somehow we've brought sort of lightheartedness in terms of the perspective that we hold it all within. Oh, I often have the slogan, take life seriously, hold it lightly.
Yeah, that's really something I've noticed among the spiritual elders that I've met. The thing they most have in common is sort of childlike glee and good sense of humor.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great. I would trust that.
So, okay, we've been talking about the heartfulness aspect. One of the guests I was talking to about what are the qualities needed to be a real successful Dharma teacher. And of course, you have to have your own serious Dharma practice. You have to be good at teaching, and those two things may not be all that correlated. You also need a lot of business skill. And you know, intense Dharma practitioner and great business skill, that's a Venn diagram with very little overlap I've seen. It sounds like you're running quite a large organization. How'd you learn how to do that?
That's another really great question. I didn't really learn it. We're just having our 20th anniversary this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And our CEO, she's brilliant. She was clearing out some old books in the office. And it's this big stack of business books that have clearly never been read. They've still got very shiny covers. And I'm sure I bought all of those. And I've tended to sort of denigrate this aspect of myself. I've tended to say, oh, we didn't really know what we were doing, and be a bit kind of negative. But I'm really reframing that. And I'm thinking, God, you know, we've actually created something that succeeded over 20 years through, you know, major global financial crisis in 2008, pandemic in 2020. We're still thriving. And the other thing that I've managed to do, which a lot of people don't manage, is founder succession. You know, very often when people start something themselves, they're successful at it, but they don't know how to hand it on. But I've really stepped back from the operational part of running the business, got a really excellent CEO, excellent team. So again, I think it's probably, I've got a bit of a knack. Like my dad was a trader. So I think I've got a sort of innate business sense. I've got a nose for opportunities. I seize opportunities.
That's what I was thinking. As I was trying to think, you know, what quality is coming through loudest from you? I think it's confidence. I think, you know, being so young when you went into the retreat center, I think most people would, instead of saying, I would regret this, spend 1,000 hours second guessing whether they would really regret it. It seems like you, from a very young age, have a lot of faith in yourself. And that's a theme I'm hearing through these stories so far.
Yeah, that's also very interesting, because I would agree with that now, but I've only reframed that story quite recently for myself. I think I've thought, I'm a bit unconfident. You don't really know what I'm doing. A good friend of mine, she once said about me that I back into things. And I think that's absolutely right. I follow my nose, very intuitive. I sort of think I don't really know what I'm doing. And then I turn around and it's like I back myself into a place of success. But I haven't been sort of heading there. I've been looking in the other direction. Then suddenly it's like, wow, okay, this is really great what I've done. But I have had a lot of faith. I have had a lot of faith, and I think I have had confidence. I think growing up in New Zealand helped. You know, I grew up in New Zealand in the 70s. I went to a good school, and the message I got was, you can do whatever you like with your life as a woman. You know, it was the early feminism. It's a small country. So you grow up with a sense that you can have an impact in a way that I think meeting people who've grown up in Britain, it's harder. And unless you're in, you know, upper class, go to a public school. But in New Zealand, there's not really a class system. And there is a sense that if you really go for something, you can succeed, you can achieve things. So I think I was very lucky to have that early conditioning and a good education.
That is very lucky. So let me ask about the teacher training program. Can you tell me a little about the specifics of it? How long the program goes, what sort of things the teachers will learn?
Okay, so it's interesting the way teacher training programs have developed here in the UK, in that very early on, we started meeting with a couple of the universities that were beginning to train people. Mindfulness has come in mainly through the academic route in the UK. I think it's very different in the States. And we're definitely not academic, you know, we're an experience-based training program. But we started meeting quite early on, and then there's been an establishment of standards, common standards across the different organizations. There's now a register. So if you follow a particular training pathway that's recognized by the register, you can get you can get registered on this list, which has got respectability and so on. So our program now has got 5 stages. The first stage is really just skilling yourself up. So you have to have at least a year of meditation practice, go on a retreat, and you also need to go on a breathworks course as a participant. And we've got 2 courses. We've got an 8-week course called Mindfulness for Health, and then an 8-week course called Mindfulness for Stress, which is the kind of adaptation of our core course, which was the health course for anybody. And then you go on an introductory training level, and that used to be mainly led as a residential retreat. But interestingly, again, this is where, you know, the universe is very mysterious, that we'd taken everything online in about January 2020, just before the pandemic.
That was good for us.
Weird. So we were, you know, very well set up for the pandemic. So at the moment, you can do that online. We may bring back the residential, but we may not, because the online's been so successful. So you do an orientation workshop, and then you do a whole online training event. You have a mentor all the way through that supports you. Then you support a course, it's application of skills. So you kind of learn about everything. And then you go and you support a course, you do a mindful movement workshop, because that's an important part of our program. And then you come back for what we call teacher training advanced. So we've got these two main aspects. There's teacher training introductory, which, as I say, used to be this residential retreat and now is online. And then teacher training advanced. And that's really where you have lots of practice at leading, getting feedback. You have your practice group, you've got your mentor, and so on. We try to create a very kind of safe learning environment so people can really give it a go and give each other feedback in a way that's helpful and constructive. And then you go on to lead a practice course. So you lead a course for people, you get evaluations at the end, you submit those to your supervisor, and if everything's good, you get accredited as a Breathworks teacher.
Wow.
And that has to take at least a year. Yeah. So we want people to take their time over all that.
So, that does sound incredibly comprehensive and rigorous. You're saying at the end, there's a certification process. Are there people who fail, who've gone through the program and eventually they hear, we really don't think you're ready for this?
Well, because I'm so good at succession planning, I don't really know at the moment. but I think it's very, very rare if it happens at all. It would be more that we would say to people, these are areas for development and we'll support you in these areas of development. So it would be, rather than saying you failed, you know, it's not a pass-fail situation. It's much more, you're really great at this, but you need to do a bit more work on this other area. So it's all very supportive and encouraging. I mean, some people don't finish, of course. They choose not to finish. That's fine. But I think by far the majority of people that get to the end do get accredited.
And is there any sieve at the beginning where somebody might say, I'd like to be in your program, and you would say, no, I don't think this is for you, or or not really?
I think possibly. Yeah, people have to fill out an application form that gets looked at by the training team, maybe have a conversation with the training team. So yeah, there's definitely, you know, we don't want people spending the money and committing the time if it's not for them. But again, generally speaking, we would welcome people onto the program. And just to say something about funding, actually, because again, this is the heart dimension. We want everybody to be able to come on the program if at all possible. So of course there are fees for people that can afford it, but we have a concessionary price scale for people who are on low income. And then we've also got a bursary option. So people who can't even afford that, we try to top it up to at least 50% of the concessionary rate. And we're a charity, so we do fundraising and so on to build up our bursary pot to enable, you know, we don't want it to just be a middle-class white educated pool of teachers. We want it to be reaching out to lots of different communities.
That's so wonderful. So I was talking to a year or two ago, a Scandinavian woman who was a yoga teacher trainer. And she was saying in Scandinavia, there's a huge market for yoga teacher training and not much of a market for yoga teachers. So the big business is in teacher training. And then it's producing a lot of teachers who don't have students. So I'm wondering what you might know about of the 600 people. Are most of these people teaching? Are they getting lots of students or not necessarily?
So again, it's a very good question. And a lot of the people who train with us, they do it as part of what's called a portfolio career. So you don't expect to be, you know, a full-time mindfulness teacher. So you might be a yoga teacher, in fact, and then want to do a mindfulness training alongside. And we get a lot of people from health professions who want to come and learn how to teach mindfulness, practice mindfulness, deepen their own practice, and then to use it in their clinical work. They might never run an 8-week program, but they want to have these skills at their fingertips to incorporate into their existing work. So we have the whole range. You know, some people lead the 8-week programs, but less and less. I think what's happening in the mindfulness field is, you know, 10, 15 years ago, 8-week programs were the standard, but there's way more diversification now into different modes of delivery. So in a way, what we're offering people is the gold standard. You know, they get the full training and then they can use it in a whole variety of different ways. And people seem quite satisfied with that because we still get a lot of people applying for our training, even though the market for 8-week courses isn't very big. But as I say, we get a lot of people who come who have another sort of allied career, you know, say a doctor, nurses, people work in hospices, physios, psychologists, of course. And then they just want to immerse themselves in a training pathway because it's very immersive, our training pathway. It's not academic. It's not theoretical. It's, you know, really getting under the bonnet of what does it mean to be aware? What does it mean to be kind? What does that feel like? How do you learn inquiry skills and so on? And they can take all that into their other work. And some people just do it for themselves. You know, they just want to do it to deepen their own practice in this very supportive, very sort of hands-on environment.
That's wonderful. It sounds like there's a lot of diversity in intention and motivation among the people becoming teachers. One big question I have, particularly when you said the number 600, is, you know, if I think of the top 10 spiritual teachers that come to mind, put up 10 fingers, and then put the fingers down for the ones with major scandals, I'm going to lose a lot of my fingers, right? I'm wondering, in such a large community, how do you handle the situation of people misbehaving?
Well, again, you see, that's such an interesting question because I would think that would be an issue. But thankfully, so far, it hasn't. And we've got code of conduct. We've got a strong code of conduct that people sign up to, you know, ethical guidelines and so on. People have to maintain their accreditation. They have to do CPD and so on every year and then submit evidence of that.
What is CPD?
Continuing professional development.
Ah, yeah.
You know, so go on.
Interesting.
Go on webinars on trauma-sensitive mindfulness, that kind of thing. Have to go on retreats every year. But I mean, thankfully, so far, I don't seem to have been implicated in any scandals, because often it's the leaders, isn't it? I think, oh, God, what's going to happen one day? But so far, nothing's come to light. And I don't think I've done anything that would warrant that. Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it, that I've done all this with a disability, which is very humbling. It's very, you know, my life is continually humbling. And I also live with Sona, who's one of the other founders. He's my husband, in fact. And he has this joke. He says his job is to make sure that my head can fit through the door. So he does quite a good job of that. So it's, you know, we keep ourselves very real. And, you know, I've got a paralyzed bowel, paralyzed bladder. That's all very messy every day. So I can't really get too full of myself. You know, this body is just very, very humbling. And I'm glad for that. I'm very glad for that. And because of my disability, I've always had to delegate. You know, I haven't been able to be a leader in the sense of doing everything. I've always had to, you know, I think one of my skills has been bringing people onto the team, encouraging. I think I'm a very encouraging person, appreciative person. But I've not been able to sort of build up that status, I suppose, as the big guru. I don't think I have. And in a way, if you're continually humiliated by your life, it's not so far to fall, I suppose, if something goes a bit wrong. You know, I think sometimes the scandals is where people have maybe lost a bit of touch with the community around them, perhaps. I mean, I'm just speculating here. But I think the fact that we do, you know, we've got codes of conduct, we've got ethical guidelines, you know, the fact that we're a very sort of clearly structured organisation, I think that helps. Because the Sangharan part or the Triratna Buddhist order, that has had scandals.
Yeah.
And of course, that's been a community of friends. That's been the kind of ethos. It's a network of friendships. Hasn't had, until recently, sort of ethical guidelines and so on, because it's all been based on trust and idealism and so on. And of course, we're not perfect humans, are we? And at Breathworks, we've had much more of a sort of, more like a sort of business organizational structure, if you like, that I think has protected us to some extent.
Okay. Yeah, that's very helpful to hear. The scandals have been so frequent that I get scared or paranoid bringing one new person in on my organization. You know, how much can I trust this person? And it sounds like you're saying you brought in 600 and some structure around it. And particularly, I would agree that the people at the top are usually in the scandal. So keeping yourself humble, putting some structure around it, has actually led to 600 teachers with nothing to worry about.
Well, nothing's come back that we're aware of. Yeah, nothing's come back that we're, or nothing major. I mean, obviously we get the normal, you know, you get some minor complaints from time to time, but they're all very resolvable and nothing, you know, nothing major. And of course we just dialogue. If someone makes a complaint, you might get someone on a retreat who is dissatisfied in some kind of way. Well, we just dialogue with them. And just to say as well, those 600 teachers, maybe this is an important point, like they're all completely independent. So that's not like they're part of the sort of Breathwork structure. They've done our training. They're a certified teacher, but they're out there completely independent without, I mean, obviously they use the Breathwork's name if they're running an accredited Breathwork's course. But from a sort of legal point of view, or a structural point of view, they're all completely independent teachers. So it's I imagine this person I think you said it was Sweden, who was a yoga teacher. I think the yoga teaching model generally, you teach training and then there you are as a yoga teacher just running your own business. So it's more like that, our model.
So how do you get that feedback? So if a Breathworks teacher, somebody complains about them, you said you received the complaints. What's the structure around that where somebody would know to contact you with a complaint?
Well, we're very open on the retreats. You know, this is where there's a head of training. So people would know who the head of training is. And the head of training is generally the one who would engage with that kind of thing and then escalate to the CEO if necessary. So again, you've got that sort of structure there. And they never come to me. You know, they're all dealt with. If we do have any complaints, they're all dealt with satisfactorily by the team. people do surveys every year. Our teachers do surveys where they let us know how they're getting on. They have to send us evaluations from time to time from their students. So I think we've got, you know, pretty good structures in place.
This has been thrilling. Thank you so much for all the detail you've been willing to share about your teacher training program and philosophy and how you got on this track. It's about time where we'll have to break. Is there anything else you'd want to share with our audience before we do?
Well, I suppose maybe just reinforcing the point I said earlier on, that I think a big reason why Breathworks has been successful is because of my motivation, and my motivation that I wanted to help people. And, you know, it's not been particularly successful financially from a you know, worldly point of view. And, you know, we've been going for 20 years. We've survived major global events. We make enough money. We're making more money now. You know, we've got our charity. We're giving away bursaries. But again, that's that kind of virtuous circle, that we make money in order to give money away to people who really need it. So I think if you're thinking of being a teacher, you know, just really look at your motivation and try to keep that heart essence alive, that heart, you know, the being moved by the plight of humanity and believing in these skills. These, you know, I think mindfulness is very simple, really, the sort of mind training skills of presence, learning how to be aware, let go of reactivity, open the heart, release into flow, expand the mind, stay in the body. You know, they're, I often say it's not rocket science. It's very difficult to do, of course, but keep it simple, keep it real. Believe in yourself, give it a go. That's another thing. Just give it a go. But yeah, keep in touch with your heart motivation would be the main thing that I would say. And as the businesswoman, right at the end, everything's online now. So if you're interested and you live in the States, you can do our teacher training pathway. So you just go to our website, which is breathworks-mindfulness.org.uk.
Vidyamala, thank you so much. This has been a thrilling conversation, and I hope we get to talk again soon.
Yeah, I really loved it. Thank you so much, Tucker. And yeah, great the work that you're doing.
Teaching Meditation is produced by John Dooley, our sound engineer. We literally cannot continue this podcast without him. And of course, his ability to keep working with us is dependent on being able to make some sort of livelihood. All of the money that we collect in the Patreon goes directly to pay for all of John's professional work. And so if you love this podcast and if you'd like it to keep going, please head over to patreon.com/teachingmeditation. We will all be so extremely grateful for anything you are able to offer.